all of our spirits are made from 100% organic rye, and we are buying the rye from farms in Montana and some other states in North America. And those are farmed without herbicides, pesticides, or any kind of lab-created chemical additives. So we're not only protecting the earth, we're protecting the farmers because they're not exposed to, you know, certain brands of pesticides and herbicides that have become famous for actually making the farm workers sick.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show where every week Jonathan and I meet with live professionals looking to get mindful advice on their business challenges. Today on the show, we have Allison Evanaugh. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, you guys.
Absolutely. So Allison's coming to us with a bit of a challenge around her post-COVID supply chain, a fascinating issue that we chatted briefly about. So we're excited to dig into that. But before we do that, Allison, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your business, and then you can explain the challenge in a little more detail.
Okay, great, great. So I'm the founder and CEO of Square One Organic Spirits. We were the first all-organic spirits company in the whole country. I started it quite some time ago. Over 18 years ago is when I first had the idea, and we launched our first product, which was a straight organic rye vodka in 2007. We have primarily been a spirits company over the course of our history. And the idea behind Square One was to really use all natural botanicals and grains as our base. None of these lab coat created flavors that are rampant, unfortunately, in the vodka category. And so everything we do is using real plant-based botanicals and infusions in our spirits. 2 years ago, we launched a line of non-alcoholic cocktail mixers like Bloody Mary, ginger syrup for Moscow Mules, lemon lime sours for different types of cocktails, and pomegranate cocktails as well. And also the ever so popular right now canned cocktails as well. But what's interesting is that those launched in the middle of COVID, and they kind of were my saving grace because they are very retail focused. Whereas my spirits line has historically been more in what we call in my industry, the on-premise, which means bars, restaurants, and hotels. So of course, we took a big hit during COVID on the sales side with spirits. And now that we're kind of post-COVID, the biggest challenge I'm facing right now is, and most people can imagine this intuitively, is that a lot of people who were bartenders, buyers, beverage people in restaurants, hotels have either moved on, or even if they're still in the industry, they're at a different place because they all were displaced. And you couple that by the fact that a lot of my distributors across the country furloughed or outright got rid of a lot of their on-premise sales divisions because there was not a whole lot to sell to. And now we're back with all new everybody. We're new buyers, new accounts, some shut down, some are still have come back, but also especially new salespeople at my distributors nationwide. And so the challenge I'm facing is, instead of just the automatic, oh, everybody's back, we're going to get all of our sales back, I need to retrain both my customer base in the on-premise for my spirits, and more importantly, my distributors. And it's, we have to do it fast. I can't just get on the plane and go visit 40 states and try to, you know, train everybody in person. So that's my challenge. I was hoping maybe we could come up with some interesting ideas for how to rapidly retrain my distributor sales force and get the brand back in front of our best customers, which are the bars, restaurants, and hotels.
Allison, just a question before we know it's urgent. We're going to get into it very quickly, but
sure.
What's the benefit of organic, or what's the negative downside of all those fillers and additives or whatever it is that's going into the other drink makers?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for asking. It's interesting because when we first started, there was a lot of skepticism. People said, well, it's alcohol. You're cleaning it up when you distill it. So what does it matter that it's organic? But really, and people do understand it now. I think the whole organic movement and all food and beverage and other categories has grown greatly over the last decade or so. And so the benefit for us specifically in organic is a combination of factors. Number one, all of our spirits are made from 100% organic rye, and we are buying the rye from farms in Montana and some other states in North America. And those are farmed without herbicides, pesticides, or any kind of lab-created chemical additives. So we're not only protecting the earth, we're protecting the farmers because they're not exposed to, you know, certain brands of pesticides and herbicides that have become famous for actually making the farm workers sick. So that's number one. Number two, and this is actually a nuance, it's not as maybe obvious to people, but most of the products in the flavored vodka category, way less so in, say, gin, which is known for using kind of botanicals, have been historically focused on creating flavors out of chemical combinations without the real flavor in existence in that final output. So I joke that they could make strawberry number 39 at a flavor house without a strawberry coming within 1,000 miles of that lab. And so we use real organic botanicals in all of our infusions. And being organic is kind of our proof point. It's a little bit like the good housekeeping seal of approval. If we have that organic seal on our bottle, you know we can't cheat. And so that's part of what it is giving you real products that we say they are and not mimicking a certain flavor profile.
Excellent.
So we'll just record that last 30 seconds and we'll send that to all of your distributors and that will be that.
Thank you. Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And before I would also just like to say, I really appreciate what you're doing generally. I think especially we talk about a lot of mindfulness on the show and organic mm-hmm. and what that represents in terms of organic practices. It's just regardless of what the product is, it's better for the planet. And it's just being more conscious in general. So we're greatly appreciative of that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things we try to do as well as a company, and we still have so many areas of improvement, but from the very beginning, we also try to incorporate as many sustainable or green practices as possible into kind of the whole process. So for example, my distillery partner that we work with, they're in Eastern Idaho, they now use 40% of their energy from wind power, and they are the largest Rocky Mountain wind power customer of Rocky Mountain Wind Power, you know, in that region. And they weren't doing that before they started working with us, when one of the things I said to them is, as my distillery partner, we both need to try to be more, you know, eco-conscious. And other things like our labels on our package, they're either made from recycled post-consumer waste paper, or they're virgin paper, but the paper's not made from a tree. It's made from bamboo, sugarcane pulp, you know, or something that's more of a byproduct of something else. And so those are some of the things we try to do along the way beyond just what's in the bottle to try to bring a little bit more of a green ethos to our product. And, you know, for example, everybody else is giving out those plastic keychains as giveaways, right? It's very common in the spirits industry to give somebody a little keychain or something. We give out basil seed packets. So we'll hand you a branded Square One basil seed packet so you can plant a little herb garden in your kitchen and use it in your cocktails. And it's definitely not going into the landfill like a keychain would.
That's great. Fantastic. So then I'm going to ask a few questions about this supply chain, because it's a very unique problem. And a lot of people aren't really talking right now about how many probably full supply chains got wiped out during COVID from a staffing perspective. And for you, it sounds like there's this aspect of you've got to start over in some ways, because your entire network, just it's like your Rolodex got burned up in flames overnight, it's a unique thing for a company to have to face, because having, you know, the proverbial Rolodex developed and cultivated is an asset. It's a company asset that was just taken from you. Yes. So I just want to ask a few more questions to contextualize this piece. Whereas you said you could just call people and you had these relationships and now you have to start them anew. I guess talk to us a little about what starting a new relationship in this space looks like and how important it is to have that established relationship to place your product.
Yes. So really the most important part is going to be the distributor. So in the beverage alcohol industry, alcohol distributors actually have a selling sales force. In the food distributor industry, so for example, my non-alcoholic cocktail mixers, by virtue of having no alcohol in them, are primarily sold through traditional natural products food distributors. And they literally are physically just kind of delivering your case. Sure, they have salespeople, but they're not out on the street every day calling on accounts as much as, say, the liquor distributors are. So our spirits distributors, they are the ones with the most feet on the street, not the brand owners. And so we rely heavily on them to present our products to, you know, new customers, whether it's a retailer or a hotel or a new bar that opened up, et cetera. And so I used to be able to pick up the phone with, you know, John or Jane Doe and say, hey, I just heard of this new place that's opening in whatever city and it's the perfect fit for my brand. Could you, you know, could you go in and try to present the brand and what kind of things do you need for me? Do you need me to support an opening, you know, trade promotion deal for a discount? If you get it on the menu, do I need to hit a certain price point? So I would be able to call those sales reps who I knew very well and say, hey, you know, how can we tackle this new opportunity? Now it's literally a cold call. I might have a list of the salespeople within my distributor, but I don't know them. And it's a whole new conversation about explaining why I feel like my brand fits in there. And a lot of them simply don't even know my brand well enough to feel comfortable to present it without me standing by them. And I can't be everywhere all the time. And so that's where I have to re-educate the whole sales force. So that they're comfortable going in when they see opportunities where my brand is a fit. I mean, they're not going to walk into a new whiskey bar with an organic vodka, but they are going to walk into an organic restaurant or eco-friendly restaurant and position my product. But a lot of times they don't even know enough about the brand to do that.
Yeah. So it's an interesting process dynamic that I want to explore a little bit more, because it sounds like if this was starting from scratch, you have to sell two relationships. You have to sell your product into the distributor. That's one.
Yes.
And then you have to kind of build rapport and kind of educate on the product within the distributor's sales force, because they're frontline for retail.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now you still have these relationships with distributors, but the secondary layer that's retail facing got gutted. And now you don't have to resell the distributor, but you have to re-educate all of their people. Am I getting that right?
Right. I don't have to resell the, let's say, the executive management to bring my product in. I'm already in that distributor in that state. And of course, again, you know, because of all the laws and alcohol, you have different distributors in every state. Even if it's owned by the same parent company, there's no crossover. If you're calling on an account in California, it's, even if it's the same distributor in another state, you're dealing with that particular state's organization versus, say, Florida. And so I still have the distribution at the macro level. We're still being sold. I'm using air quotes because it's not being sold enough, you know, after COVID. We're there, but now I have to get down to the street level people and re-educate them on my brand. Mm-hmm. And, because we are a hand sell brand. I mean, we're at our price point. We are in the luxury category. We're at $30-something price point. This is not just something where you go into an account and just you sell it in on price. You have to sell it in on how it's made, why it is what it is. And in particular for our brands, being that they are cocktail menu brands, you have to sell the bartender on why they should put our brand in a certain cocktail to make them more money. And so that's not just selling the product. It's selling what I call a cocktail solution or cocktail solution selling. And that is in and of itself a whole, you know, a whole different thing for new people. A lot of my distributors have people who've come in into the on-premise sales divisions who have never really sold in the on-premise. And that's because a lot of them left. They left the industry. And so they're literally, pardon the pun, starting at square one.
Yeah.
I had to get that in somewhere.
Oh, of course.
How did you build it the first time?
The way I'm saying now, but you know, with the luxury of every account was a new account, yay, versus now where we have an infrastructure in place that needs sales, right, to support that infrastructure. But it was that way. It was very much going to the market. I opened 100 accounts in the on-premise, you know, on my own with the help of a part-time brand ambassador. So between the two of us, we opened 100 accounts in San Francisco when I very first started in 2006. And that's when we said, okay, we can't open anymore because we can't handle delivering, you know, to 100 accounts. And that's when we first got a distributor. And then the general rule of thumb with liquor distributors is you are, you know, flying to the state and you're getting in front of the sales force and you literally only get usually 15 or 20 minutes max. And you're educating them on the product. Now, the good news about COVID is that pre-COVID, I used to say to my distributors, why are you making me get on an airplane for a 15-minute meeting? Wouldn't you rather have me spend that money on sales incentives for your people or whatever? But they just literally were not equipped to host, you know, Zoom meetings or whatever. Now they are. So that's the good thing is you can get away with some Zoom meetings. But there is just something lacking when you cannot be right in front of that sales force or in a more engaging way, in a how-to way, and you've only got 10 minutes and people are looking at their phones and whatever versus some other alternative to both in-person, face-to-face, and some other creative way, which is what I'm hoping we might come up with some creative ways today that are not just Zoom calls.
Yep.
Are all ultimate buyers the same equal, like in terms of the result for you?
You mean the person who's finally buying the product and using the product?
Exactly.
Well,
the person who ultimately has to receive the message and make a decision.
Yes. So again, the on-premise versus retail, the ultimate buyer at retail is the end consumer. And it doesn't mean that the end consumer is not your ultimate buyer in a bar either, but they have less of a decision-making tree, if you will, in the on-premise than and less distraction of choices in the on-premise versus, say, retail. So if we just look at the on-premise, which is where my challenge lies more so than retail, we didn't lose retail distribution where we had it. We just, you know, whereas, you know, we lost and now we have to regain. Yeah. So yes, it does matter because the person who we call them the gatekeeper, the bartenders and the bar buyers are the gatekeepers. And so not only do they need to buy into having the product on their shelf, but in an ideal world, they drink the Kool-Aid. They understand how the brand is made, what makes it special, what makes it different. And in addition to maybe putting it on the cocktail menu, which matters way more than just sitting on that back bar because your velocity is a lot faster when people only have 10 cocktails to choose from and they don't want to think about what they're ordering. But you want them to be able to say, hey, there's this really cool product. It's female owned, female founded. They were the first all organic spirits company in the whole country. And instead of that big name mass brand, which may be fine, isn't it cool to maybe try something new from an entrepreneur? So ultimately, the best bartenders in the country are the ones who are also telling our story at the bar to the consumer ordering. And so the training all the way through to that is vital.
And you're training the people that are then pitching to the bartenders.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
So before
and
we...
since oh, go, Sam.
I was going to say the incentive structure you started to mention, I do have another, I think I want to pick at that just a little bit before we dive in, which is, so you're in the distributors are the ones who sales folks are out there selling sort of these on-premise accounts. What is the incentives there? Why would they prioritize learning you versus any other accounts of the distributor? Could you talk a little bit about those dynamics process-wise?
That is a fabulous, fabulous question because it's kind of, it is like the million-dollar question. So obviously what's important is for them to present a product that they feel fits that account to the degree that it will generate, you know, multi-case sales that then affect their commission, right? So like I said, they're not going to walk into a new whiskey bar and they have 15 whiskeys, you know, in their portfolio and they're going to present a vodka. They're not, because then they aren't going to make enough money. They're going to present, you know, whiskey. But same thing holds with some brand that might be, you know, knowingly made with fake ingredients, if you will. They're not going to present that to a sustainable account. So really the key for them is understanding their target, which products in their portfolio fit the target, and which products they present have the best chance for placement and velocity, because the velocity is going to put money in their, you know, in their pocket. So as an example, my Square One Cucumber Organic Vodka, first cucumber vodka in the world, launched in 2008. It is one of those that I tell my sales reps, this is your moneymaker. This is the one, if you have a patio bar that people are outside and they're drinking two or three drinks over the course of maybe 2 or 3 hour meal because it's relaxing or whatever. Those are this is the product that is so fresh and refreshing that you want it on the cocktail menu. It's going to make you, you know, a lot of money. Whereas if they're going into let's say a steakhouse, right? We do have some national placements at J. Alexander Steakhouse, at Morton Steakhouse, at Steak 48, which is based out of, it's a small chain based out of Scottsdale, Arizona. And guess what sells in a steakhouse? Martinis, right? So it is about identifying what cocktail and what product will make them the most money in the right account. And they have to filter through their portfolio and make that decision. But a lot of times it's easier just to sell the product that's got the biggest buzz of the moment and forget that some of the other products in their book.
Mm-hmm. And you don't control who they target as customers typically. You just kind of have to know, you have access to know their general retail targets, but beyond that,
we generally know who their, what we call it, their account universe. And different distributors of different sizes have different account universes. And so within that world of account universes, we will tell them we are targeting A, B, and maybe C plus accounts. Because our price point is not going to really get us into most C accounts, because those tend to be, you know, accounts that have maybe $7 cocktails instead of $13 cocktails on the menu. And so we do help them identify where we fit, both conceptually and price point wise. And they kind of know going in what products in their portfolio can fit in that target.
Mm-hmm. So then in terms of that helps me understand the interactivity and now yeah. the constraints. So you talked about that one of the biggest constraints is the 10 or 15 minutes that you have exposure. Could you give me a better sense of, is this something you can schedule any time? Do you have like once a quarter a slot? Like what is the actual time and exposure constraints that you have to these new retail contacts?
Yes. So when I go to the market, let me give you a couple examples. I was in San Francisco 2 weeks ago and I was working, with one of the sales reps, and they had, you know, 8 accounts for us to call on, and it was allowing me to go in and call on them. And I can kind of schedule those more or less whenever I want based on their calendar and my calendar. And I do that, but the distributor one is the key one, because educating 150 salespeople in the state of California is going to be far more effective than me calling on 8 accounts in one day in San Francisco. So they do have sales meetings about once a month. But you got to get in line to present. And one of the factors of COVID has been nobody's been able to effectively present to the sales force outside of Zoom, you know, in 2 years. And everybody's clamoring to get on that sales meeting. And I remember when I was in San Francisco and I was having dinner with the sales reps, they said, well, it's actually really good that you came here because we're managers. We can trickle down, you know, the information, because you wouldn't want to be at that sales meeting on Friday where there's like 30 people, you know, presenting and then reps can't remember. So it is constrained by time of the distributor having the time to have a sales meeting, having everybody come in person for that. And then it's constrained by how many brands they feel need to present that are priorities for them to educate their staff on. So right now there's just this really big bottleneck, and it's not any one distributor's fault. It's what happened with COVID, and it's happening all over the country with pretty much every distributor. And I'm trying to figure out how to break through that bottleneck without getting on an airplane and going to every state, which will take me 6 months to do.
But all the distributors are the distributors are all looking at each manufacturer as being equal in terms of they're just looking for who are they going to get the most sales from.
Yes. Like
that's their objective.
Yes.
So your mission is I don't want to say irrelevant, but it's only relevant to the extent that it could result in more sales.
Correct. Correct.
What I was trying to get at before with the, you know, looking at the how the market might have shifted, it might, there's probably more organic, more awareness, as you said, than maybe the first time you went around it.
Right.
Is there any other process besides or in addition to the distributors to tap into the sense of mission so that there's either more pull or the people that are trained have more, are more likely to generate their own sense of mission other than the incentives alone?
I think that is maybe if we had a takeaway from that today, and some ideas for that, that would be good, because I do feel like the pull is really important. And that's more what I've been working on, you know, during and after COVID, is I am trying to do more of my own contacting, even if it's desktop contacts, because they're 4 states away, to present my brand via email or something, or a call, to create that. But that's not terribly efficient either. It's literally, again, one by one. So I would love to find a solution to that.
Unless anyone who's fits that profile thought on their own, hey, I should be reaching out for this.
Right. And actually it does, it has always happened and it's happening again. It's interesting. I belong to this kind of Facebook group called Who's My Rep? And it was started by an industry person who has tons and tons of experience in on both sides of the industry, at the bar and on the sales side. And he was saying one of the biggest challenges a lot of the bar people are facing right now is they don't know who's who, even at their distributor, at their supplier. And people like me are called suppliers. We're the ones that own the brand. They don't know who the supplier rep is in their region. They don't know who the distributor rep is in their region. And they're starting to create new menus and new things. And they literally will go on and post on Facebook, okay, I'm opening a new bar, or I'm doing the new beverage menu for XYZ restaurant. Here are the brands I'm interested in. Who are the reps? Or here are the categories I'm interested in. Who are the reps? And one woman recently posted, these are the things I want. And then at the end, she said, by the way, if there are any women-owned brands, ping me. So I'm like, I'm right in there, right? So there are ways for us to get there, because there is a lot of pull requests right now because of all of the chaos. So it could be very good to just kind of not rely only on trying to re-educate my distributors, but to do a really good job of getting directly in front of the bartenders to let them know we exist and facilitate coordinating them with the new
or reps. the owners,
right?
Like, because it's inconsistent with their mission if they have a specific mission and they're serving products that are inconsistent with that mission,
right?
And so the question is, where are they going? Because it's not just the distributors who are, you know. So you said somebody makes a list of all the products they want to buy. Mm-hmm. How do they make that list, and where are they going for that information?
Where would they
even think to go?
Well, generally speaking, it's just, you know, brands they've heard of, they've seen the press, or they've actually had in a past bar program. A lot of it is, you know, press driven, buzz amongst the community. The bartending community is very tight. They're, you know, even nationally, they all kind of know each other at certain levels. For those that it truly is a profession, not, you know, a side gig. And they will talk amongst each other. So things like the United States Bartender Guild, you know, one of the things we can and should be doing is, and we did it in the past, is go back out and schedule meetings with the U.S. Bartenders Guild. And then in that particular city, they are bringing 20, 30 people from different restaurants to the meetings. And then we are sponsoring the meeting, lunch or whatever, and get to present to the bars. So those are some of the things that we did in the past and probably can and should be doing again. But it's funny how it's all happening at once, instead of usually it's by stages. Yeah. And now it's more like, okay, you know, where do we put the finger in the dike so that we can get back to the volume that we had before COVID? Mm-hmm.
And is there any restriction from the, going back to the distributor sales reps for a moment, is there any restriction from them reaching out to you if they want to learn more about your product? Like, because the way we're describing it is the only interaction point is between in those sales meetings where you're fighting for space? Can, if they were interested right. in building the brand better, can they reach out to you?
They can. I will tell you, in all actuality, they are all drinking from the fire hose
yep.
all day, every day. And they are under normal circumstances. So now it's even worse. And I think a lot of times they may have the thought, oh, I really wish I knew more about Square One Organic. I know it's organic, but I don't know because I'm new or whatever. And then I think in a way, sometimes they hold back because they just have so much on their plate. And that part I understand, right? I can't ever get upset with my distributor salespeople when I know they're trying to learn, you know, hundreds and hundreds up to thousands of brands, but they can, and some do, but it's not as often as you would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where I think I'm ready to start giving some creative ideas.
Okay.
So from my
side. Those are all great questions, by the way. You really dug in fast. You kind of pinpointed it. So
yeah, it's our kind of crazy process vision. So I'm building the mm-hmm. process. So now I can kind of take a look. So the thing I would say, the first thing, I want to start a little higher level, because what I would advise is, in the present moment, if you take away the historical precedent, what you're trying to do is going to be very difficult. And there's a lot of what you're trying to do that's driven by trying to recreate what was lost in the right. pre-COVID market. And that's going to, as a starting point, I just want to call attention to it, because it can strain your thinking. Because the purpose, right. your purpose right now is to build relationships, but the true value objective is that those relationships yield the sales of your product at a velocity right. that will kind of match what you had before. But there's a lot of different ways you can do that. So like you mentioned, this frustration and this tension you feel about getting in line and doing what every other supplier is trying to do to recreate the network that they had, mm-hmm. that's going to inherently be, it's almost like a reactionary response to trying to create yeah. what was lost. And that's why I'm going to bring this conversation to the present moment, where what you're looking at is all these distributor relationships and now no sales relationships all of a sudden. So if you kind of erase right. the past and you focus on, like, what am I trying to solve right now and what is the most efficient way to solve it, it may not necessarily be waiting in line. And how can I, but we can talk about right. that too, but I just wanted to put that out there because it will start to change, I think, the way we think about the situation.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, you look like you were going to add to that.
No, that's exactly what I was, that was the point of all of my questions, was that you're, it's a whole new world right now.
Yeah.
And so there's good and bad about it, because the good is you don't have to educate maybe quite as much about the benefits of organic and the like, and maybe there's a lot more people that are open to it. The bad is that you have a conception of what success is, and you're trying to get back to it and get back to it the same way. But the reality is, whatever it is today, it's day one today.
Yeah.
And so the question is, in a new world where maybe organic is, where sense of mission is maybe stronger in terms of you have a larger community of people who might feel the same way, is there a way to tap into that and simultaneously put some effort into the old process, but look at it as for the reality that it is? Because you're almost saying, how do I scale those interactions? But in some instances, people aren't even, you wouldn't even have the opportunity to get into that,
right.
into that
right.
queue. So right. like it might not even be a viable option in some scenarios. And letting it go rather than trying to, not fully letting it go, but I'll give a couple of suggestions there, but not trying to just put all the energy to recreate something that may not exist again,
right.
is will free you up to conceive of other possibilities.
Right. And that's exactly what I was hoping would be part of our discussion today, because I know I'm kind of, you know, I'm blocked in the sense that I'm used to the way it used to happen. And because we had distribution and we had success, if I went to a sales meeting, I went because maybe there was a new sales manager or a few new people, or I was going to work the market. And so I said, well, if I'm going to work with a rep, I might as well go to the full sales meeting, and I'm here. And it was refresh their memory and retrain, but not retrain the whole country. So you're right.
And the other thing that it points out, I'll just add just one more comment, Sam, is the difference between scaling when there's a sense of mission and scaling where you're equal to all your competitors. So if everyone's equal in terms of just, it's just a price, and there is no additional value to the mission, that could evaporate in one event like COVID.
Right.
If there's a sense of mission, that can persist, because people will keep searching that, and that'll create a greater pull. So that's why some of where I was going was a suggestion about how to generate some more of that mission and pull, and rather than just trying to compete the way you have successfully, amazingly, but not as sustainably.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I like that.
Yeah, and the whole idea, I think I'm going to come back to this too, on push versus pull. We're going to talk about that, because a lot of your frustration energetically is that now you're getting into this frenzy with everyone else in your position where you're pushing and you're trying to push into a crowded room.
Yes.
And like, how do we generate pull is going to be a central theme in some of the advisement I think we're about to give, because you're never going to succeed pushing in any scalable way, because trying to push yourself into a crowded room to do networking, it's like, we all, you know better than we do, it's a definition of insanity. Like when you see a room full of people and you're trying to shoulder in to like shake a hand and give a card, it's very difficult. And that brings me to a point where I want to articulate, which is you're not, you came onto the show saying we need to figure out how to scale this training or scale this message. But what you're actually trying to do is scaling relationship building. And there's a huge difference there, because what you lost was the relationships. You didn't lose somebody who could learn about your product and could talk about your product. You lost the knowledge of how that could benefit them. You lost a reciprocal relationship where you had somebody you could call who could benefit from engaging with you. When you think about rebuilding that from scratch, you're not going to recreate that by throwing knowledge at the person, because that's not how you build a relationship. So it would be kind of the wrong direction to say, because we could help you through, we could have jumped on and said, like, there's all these videos you could make and there's all these different digital things you could do. But what you're fundamentally articulating is you're trying to think about it like, how can I get my information back to these people that don't know me and expect them to wield it? But what you actually need to scale is the relationship building component, which is more difficult.
Right. Yeah, especially because when I think back to the days of pre-COVID and even earlier times when maybe there were sales reps who left pre-COVID and we could pick up the phone and I would say, hey, you know, I really need your help getting a couple more accounts because we're not really going to hit our numbers. And I know you love the brand and I know you know how to sell the brand. And it was very much this one-on-one. And they're like, yeah, I'm going to do this for Allison and I'm going to do this for Square One. And I want to do that. That doesn't exist at all. And so you're right. It's got to go beyond the transaction of the training, because then the loyalty that I was able to build over the years was very thick, you know, and that's gone. And so it's not just the retraining. I think that's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to, just a quick tangent. How do you do the training now though? Like, is it all just live? You like just speaking to it?
Yeah. I mean, it's still very driven by Zoom a lot of times, because only a few distributors have finally opened up to in-person training, but it's kind of the same format one way or the other, whether it's Zoom or other. And it's literally just kind of presenting on a PowerPoint to them about the different products, the profiles, and most importantly for me, how to sell my brand in that's different than competitors or other things. So it's very product driven and very cocktail solution driven training, and very dry, because especially when it's on Zoom, you don't even get to say hello to the people on the way in the room or out of the room. And believe it or not, even in those in-person trainings, just the few seconds you might be able to make eye contact and have a quick hello with somebody is better than somebody just on Zoom.
And that's the relationship side. And I'm just thinking purely of, you had mentioned before, if somebody wanted to know information, they'd be confused where to go, or I'm wondering even if they knew where to go, what would they see? So to the extent that the original question was, you know, how do I scale this? And, you know, we're always looking to automation. I think we would still recommend that you have very short bits available for people. Right. And I would still record what you do, because that'll focus your energy on what elements of the message are unique and what elements of the message are really not relevant, because I was just, it was all what happened after the presentation that mattered. Because you still need to solve that problem, because once there's pull, the drive for information or knowledge goes up and you won't be able to scale that either. Right. So you definitely need to have those available. And for that, 15 minutes is way too long anyway. because like people's attention span is about 250 words.
Right.
So you want to just nail the message for each drink and have it available somewhere. And that way when you can direct the people there, so you're just focused on relationship building, not education.
Right.
I was going to double down on that point, which is big, which is your technical knowledge. That's easy to transcribe. So get that on the website. And then all, if you had a 15 minute slot and you're jostling with all the other people on Zoom, you only need 3 minutes of it. And really, just to be creative, I would say, hi, I'm Allison Evanall. I want to meet you. Please reach out to me for a meeting. And I'd love to tell you my story. I'd like to see how I can help you sell more to our particular, you know, target. Entice them to come to you, create pull back to you, because you're never, it's like if you're playing by their game, which is you've got a 15 minute Zoom slot and you think you're just going to pack as much information in it as possible, it's the wrong game to play, because you're never going to win that game with strangers. So, you know, you'd be better off not having a single drink in your slot and posting, like I said, your picture, your story, your contact information, a link to your site, but also focusing on them, what's in it for them, building reciprocity, because that's the way you scale relationships. Which is, I know you, I know our customer, I can help you make a ton of money, just to be, if that's what they want to hear. And like, to do that, let's get into a quiet room, like a Zoom room, and let's talk and let's meet. And like, there's going to be some people that bite and some people that don't. But the scalability and the sustainability aspect of that is those who don't, you're going to have to wean them out of your new network. And then you go and replace them with people who are willing to meet you in the virtual space. Because otherwise, this is the new world. And like you said, you don't want to stand in line and be in that rat race trying to recreate authentic connection that way, because that's not how it's going to work. You've got to kind of change the game a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So fewer potential reps, but higher percentage of believers.
Right. And that has always been true in our industry, where they say, you know, let's again use California, big state, lots of people, lots of sales reps. The general rule of thumb is, as an independent small brand, not one that's got the budgets to get everybody's attention, because, you know, they can get incentives, you know, paid all over the place from different big brands. If you can get five people to be your believers, that who they touch will make the difference. You know, everybody needs to be trained, but if you can have five or six who really believe it and really understand the brand and you and the relationship with you, and have that personal connection, they will build your success. So you've really spot on the relationship building is more important than the actual training part, because those five or six people are going to generate a lot more business for me than 150 that happen to know the product knowledge. But no,
so you just need to make sure that it's very simple for people. Organic sustainability, if your mission is similar, then this is who you should be reaching out to.
Right.
And you should be blasting that. And that takes a minute.
Yeah.
And if I knew I had 15 minutes ahead of me in a presentation, and then someone told me I'm only going to take 1 minute of your time, I'm going to listen very closely to that 1 minute. And maybe a lot of people will dismiss it because it's not part of what their mission is, or they don't see the connection necessarily to sales. But the ones who do will know to pull, will know to come to you very quickly. So
what you're pitching is why they should be friends with you. That's what you should be broadcasting. And that's the scalability aspect, which is if you separate the technical stuff and the drink information, which is universal, and create pull for them to come to you to get it, all you're selling is this. And it's a very compelling sell. Like, you sold us in the first minute of the thing, right? You are really, you're one of the progenitors of more conscious spirits, production and consumption. I mean, I would think right now that's a very compelling story. And if you're just throwing drinks and you make you downplay yourself, comparing yourself to all the other drinks, just say, you know, we're available. We want to create a relationship. And really the process you want to focus on, the scalable aspect, is why would they want a relationship with you? What's in it for them? Yeah. What are that you going to do for them if they put in the time to reach out and create that relationship? But you're never going to push a relationship on somebody. You've got to basically, you think of it more of like the process is speed dating. Why would they want to talk to you? Why would they like you? From a supplier standpoint, and then bring them in, and don't chase people that don't come. It's like setting a boundary, because that's how it makes it sustainable, your effort. Because like you said, you can't fly everywhere now. You can't recreate what you had.
Yeah.
And my wife, we only have organic here. She'll search it out. Like, so in other words, it's not that community care about it, they're not going to be, oh, well, I guess there's no choice. Here's the option that I have, like something with, you know, strawberry 39 in it. That's not an option. So there's a lot of pull that already exists. And the question is, like I was saying before, the people that are purchasing, either the consumers that are going to push the restaurant, or I think it's really the restaurants, if they know that this is available, mm-hmm. you know, and it would be consistent. So I think it's identifying, in addition to the distribution channel you have, again, where are they going for their information, or how to get information in front of them in a scalable way? What sources of information, what things are they reading, what social media, et cetera, and trying to be there as much as possible.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I had an experience just a couple of weeks ago in a market that I was working the market with my sales broker, and we walked into a retail store, not on premise, where my particular distributor had a lot of their brands placed and Square One was nowhere. And we presented it to the buyer and he had never heard of it. And he started tasting, you know, he heard the story. He started tasting through, and halfway through, he said, "You are very underrepresented in this market. How do I not know about your brand?" And he literally took a picture, sent it to his sales rep for my distributor, and basically embarrassed her for the fact that she didn't know. And that's interesting, because his whole point was, I want to and need to be carrying these different spirits, these organic spirits. I didn't even know they existed. And to your point, if I can make that rep believe that they need to have my product there because it makes them look good, because he was mad at her, right? Yeah. He was mad that she hadn't presented the product. And so that's a very interesting thing you said, because I experienced it in that way, that because the relationship was not there, she didn't know me, she didn't know my brand, she didn't feel compelled to bring my brand, and I went to a retailer, and then he got mad at her. So it's like, I kind of have to help them know where our brand can be sold to make them look good.
Yeah, and that, you know? And that right there is what would go into the training, in my yeah. opinion. So, you know, okay. The other thing about building relationships is be as transparent and honest and authentic as possible, because authenticity is what is the gold of building relationships very quickly. So like, if you started the presentation and said, "I'm not going to bore you with a bunch of drinks today, but I want you to not be the salesperson that doesn't know about this organic brand and this niche right. and this thing," don't be left out. And like, if you're interested, right. I want to talk to you, learn more, come to me, and like entice people. But whatever the yeah. conversation point is, make it real, because you've had the experience. You're out there in the market. Yeah. You know how it works. So just use the platforms you have to talk to salespeople. Don't inundate them with information. Have a conversation. That's the thing you just want to write down. And one thing I would suggest yeah. from a tactical perspective is, the last time you actually talked to one of these salespeople in person and you feel like you channeled an authentic interaction and actually started to build a relationship quickly with a new person, recount that experience, write down the process, write down the conversation and the talking points. And then that's what you want to strengthen and fortify into any sort of channel you have available to try to draw them to you. Because that's the only way, mm-hmm. based on what you're telling us about how this new world is playing out. You'll never succeed trying to, like I said, wedge your way in.
Right, right. Yeah, it's like we have to poke the hole from underneath the hourglass, you know, the sand is yeah. stuck in the hourglass and I'm trying to push it through. And instead I've got just one little pinhole through that sand will hopefully unlock the bottleneck. So,
and what you described is a general, what we espouse in every domain, which is when you feel a lot of resistance, when you give energy to resistance, you're just going to reflect resistance back at you. There's always going to be a way yeah. where if you create the space to kind of feel into what you're experiencing, there always would be another hole to pin prick or a shortcut or a different way to look at it. But generally, if you yeah. feel blocked, it's a sign that it's not where you should be spending your energy. Go to places where you feel excitement, where you're having success. And that, because that's the basis of a sustainable process effort on your part from a business perspective. Because if you feel like yeah. this is hard work, how do I continue to push through this hard work? You're failing before you start, because you should always be yeah. pushing where the work feels easier or comes to you more easily.
Yeah, that's so, it's so funny. That is so helpful, just to flip the mindset. of that for me, because I, you know, I have been like, how do I get back? How do I get back? How do I get back? You know, it's just weird how just a little bit of words can change the way that I think about the process. And I think that example in the retailer was, I mean, I walked out of there on cloud nine because he's like, I'm bringing them all in. And where have you been? And where has this been? And, you know, and I've been doing this for a very long time. And so it was kind of one of those like, see, there's still ways to do it. But you're right. I think if I had just pushed the rep instead of some finding a way to be more positive on that way, you know, we might see more, a little bit faster, if you will, rescaling of the business. Yeah. So thanks. That's great advice.
Because imagine the difference in the energy of pushing all the sales reps and having to replicate all of that versus doing a few of those interactions with that buyer, because that buyer is a believer. That buyer is going to generate a lot more energy. So if you talk about scalability, that's obviously better for your energy, which means that it's going to be better for actually ultimate sales.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a better place to be trying to scale those opportunities than sales reps that might evaporate again.
Yeah. Well, and they do. I mean, there's going to be natural turnover all the time. You're constantly retraining, right? But that is interesting because we happen to be retraining en masse right now. And that's where it just can't, we've got to have some pinpricks that get a little grains of sand through there, on the other way around. So I think that's super insightful what you've shared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know we've given you a lot, and we kind of, sometimes we pull the rug under people because you think you're going to answer one thing and we end up answering another, but I'll reflect back at you at this point in the conversation, because we've given you a lot. How are you feeling? Is there anything particularly tactical we can answer? Do you have any last burning questions?
Not really, because I just think you've just reframed things for me. So, which I feel is very macro. I almost kind of don't want to ask a very specific question, because then I'm worried it'll take me down a different rabbit hole. Whereas I think the overarching kind of thought process of building, yes, training is necessary. We have to retrain, and it has to be there for everybody. And some quick hit videos and things like that, that we can send, or it's hard to have them on our website, because believe me, my competitors are very quick to copy us. We've been copied from day one. So I kind of don't want to have it on our website. But anyway, that's a side note. But being able to do the training, but not look at it as like, I have to train the trainers or I'm going to fail. It's like, yeah, we have to train the trainers, but the relationship part, I feel, is what I used to have and has gone away. And I've got to find a way to rebuild that, because the few relationships, whether it's with the retailer, like this particular gentleman who I know is now, you know, going to tell other people what a great brand we have and hand sell it to consumers. That I think is what's going to really unblock, the bottleneck, more than people feeling they have the technical knowledge to go in. Because I think that has been part of our overall success over the years has been relationship based. And right now I don't feel it's relationship based, and I'm going back to training. And I think, I know I'm repeating myself, but it's because I'm trying to kind of get it in my head, what you guys have given advice on. And I think it's spot on.
Yeah, it's great. I always just like to, we're going to wrap up here in a second. I just want to make sure I know you came in with a very tactical mindset. So we always like to make sure we're not failing you in anything particularly tactical. But what you just reflected is where I also would say you're internalizing that paradigm shift. And I can feel in you, you have the creativity, you have the means, you know, how to talk to your product, and you know how to make it in different things. It's just you weren't putting that knowledge, applying it to the right process. And with this shift, you will be able to be unblocked. And I already can feel it. There's a lot of your own creativity that will start coming back forth to kind of tackle this, because you're not going to feel like you're walking uphill with a weight on your back. And that's going to change the perspective. And so that's what I was just confirming. But I don't think you really need a lot of tactical advice. So it's really nice to hear you saying that back. I think with this, once you internalize, it will kind of give you a fresher start on a new direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you. Very, very helpful.
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you, Allison, for coming on the show. It's been a real treat speaking with you. And I'm sure, you know, your industry is fascinating. Really love your mission and your products. So for everyone listening, thank you for tuning in. If you or anyone you know would like to come on the show, we love guests. We love your comments. We love your engagement. But other than that, thank you again, Allison, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.